This is VOA News. I'm Nicole Livas. A tsunami believed to be triggered by a volcanic eruption killed at least 222 people in Indonesia during a busy holiday weekend, sweeping away hotels, hundreds of houses, and a group attending a beach concert. 800 are injured, 28 still missing. Reuters' Grace Lee reports this is a deadly year for Indonesia.
2018 saw earthquakes flatten parts of the tourist island of Lombok, claiming the lives of almost 100 in August. Thousands more were killed after a double quake and tsunami hit Sulawesi Island 2 months later. Anak Krakatau, an active volcano located halfway between Java and Sumatra, has been spewing ash and lava for months, erupting again just after 9 p.m. on Saturday.
Look for updates on voanews.com. The U.S. federal government entered the second day of its partial shutdown Sunday, and it won't be until after the Christmas holiday that Congress and President Donald Trump can try to agree to a resolution. The sticking point is money for a wall on the U.S. border with Mexico. The president wants Congress to allocate $5.7 billion towards it. He promised it during his campaign that Mexico would pay for it, something Mexico has repeatedly rejected. On Twitter Sunday, Trump continued to push for a wall. The shutdown affects a quarter of the government. U.S. national parks are left with just a skeleton staff, and several states are using their own funds to make sure public restrooms get cleaned and visitor centers stay open. Here's what some U.S. citizens in Washington, D.C. have to say about it.
It's just supposed to be the holiday season. We're all supposed to be in good spirits, having a nice time. And now people are going to be worried about not working. Like, how are they going to afford to buy their kids presents? How are they going to afford to pay the next bill? And it's just It's a shame, honestly.
People that are caught up in this, you know, thousands and thousands of government workers didn't do anything. They work for the museums, they work for the parks, they work for the FBI, and they're the ones that are going to be punished.
More than half of the federal government employees are working without pay during this partial shutdown. This is VOA News. The White House says they want a defense secretary that agrees with the president when it comes to pulling troops out of Syria. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney says President Trump and outgoing Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis didn't always agree.
The president has told people since the campaign that he wanted to get out of Syria. I think he's entitled to have a Secretary of Defense who is committed to that same end.
But former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says sometimes presidents need to reassess their campaign promises once they're in office.
The question the president has to decide is whether he upholds his oath of office as President of the United States to protect our security, or whether he's simply going to move forward and fulfill campaign promises.
While Mulvaney was on ABC's This Week, Panetta appeared on Fox News Sunday. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Protests over worsening economic conditions have resumed in Sudan, with thousands taking to the streets. The ongoing protests have taken on an increasingly political slant, with demonstrators calling on President Omar al-Bashir to step down. He came to power in a coup 29 years ago. Rescue teams found the bodies of 9 construction workers Sunday who had been trapped inside a burning potash mine in Russia's Ural Mountains. A fire broke out Saturday at the mine operated by a fertilizer company in the Perm region, where 2 teams of workers were doing maintenance while the mine had shut down operations. 8 managed to get out, but the 9 who died were in a different section. British police have released a man and woman they arrested Friday in connection with the drone incursions that hampered operations at Gatwick Airport for 3 days. The 2 were not charged and are no longer suspects. Detective Chief Superintendent Jason Tingley of Sussex and Surrey Police says they've been following a number of leads.
That has included house-to-house inquiries with regards to where we have reported sightings of drone incursions. We are also following up a number of leads in terms of persons of interest.
More than 43 million passengers a year travel through Gatwick. Former Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn will remain behind bars after a Tokyo court added another 10 days to his detention. He faces new allegations that he manipulated Nissan into bearing the cost for $16 million in his personal investment losses. Ghosn was first detained on November 19th on suspicion of conspiring to understate his Nissan income by about 50% between 2010 and 2015. More than 75,000 well-wishers paid their respects to Japan's Emperor Akihito, who turned 85 on Sunday. It's his last birthday celebration at Tokyo's Imperial Palace before stepping down next year. I'm Nicole Livas, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington.
Think that the government, you know, succeed to establish proper policy to administer the resources of the country, I think that this will be and pave the way for the final solution of such crisis.
Sudanese opposition leader calls on the government to peacefully hand over power.
I think we will succeed. Even that other time, we knew that we will succeed. This is why probably they checked around here that how do we delay it? Okay? So you can delay an issue, but you cannot succeed to stop it. Because it's a constitutional matter anyway.
Zambian main opposition party plans to impeach President Edgar Lungu when parliament reopens next year.
Expressing a desire to contest for a higher position, expressing ambition, appears forbidden within the ruling party.
And Botswana President Eric Masisi replaces a cabinet minister for announcing plans to challenge him for the leadership of the ruling party. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. An advisor to the Sudanese communications minister says the government is ready to implement new measures to improve the economy. Dr. Rabi Ablaiti Obaede, prominent member of the ruling National Congress Party, or NCP, also says the administration will support an independent inquiry into the violence which left at least 10 protesters dead and dozens more injured. The demonstrators were protesting against the rising cost of food and fuel. For the latest development regarding the protest, I reached Dr. Obaid in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
I don't think that there is any demonstration, and the situation now, even in these remote towns, now becoming very quiet, and life is running as normal, and there is nothing we can say that about any demonstrations, and all the people, the governmental organizations and the governmental institutions, in addition to the private sector institutions and businessmen, all those that are now resuming their work without any interruption or without any demonstration that affecting the movement of the people. And some arrangements now taken by the government to review the economical situation and the policies of how to administer the economy and how to remove these reasons behind the administration.
Some people are calling for an independent investigation to how the government brutally tried to suppress the protests by violently attacking protesters. Is your government ready to be part or accept an independent investigation into this?
Yes, according to our constitution, that free expression is one of the rights of citizens. And demonstration also is a right of citizens to demonstrate and to protest against any policies that not meeting the requirements of the people or creating any obstacles for their life. And I think that the victims in these demonstrations and the loss really will be a subject for investigation, so that to see who is behind the destruction of the belongings of the people and the property of the people, and also who is behind the violence that resulted in the victims, especially those who killed in during these demonstrations and protests.
Sadiq Al-Mahdi, the leader of the National Umma Party, said the Sudanese government should accept a peaceful transfer of power or to engage in a losing battle with the Sudanese people, because he said President al-Bashir and his government have failed to address the needs of the people, which he said led to the demonstrations in the first place.
Yes, I think that this is the opinion of the leader of Umma Party, Sadiq Al-Mahdi. But actually, who is, have an authority to govern and to rule about the performance of the government is not Sadiq Al-Mahdi or any leader of any political party. I think that to rule and to evaluate the performance of the government, this is the function of the people of the Sudan. And this function can be only performed if free election is convened. And I think that now this government is preparing for free election, transparent election, and monitored election. And after that, we will see whether Sadiq al-Mahdi is actually ruling a correct rule, or this will consider only or will represent only his own opinion.
The government doesn't seem to have money to address this economic crisis that Sudanese face. So how will the government review and resolve this, since the government cannot even pay its diplomatic missions or officers abroad?
You know that actually our country is a very rich country. I think that the production of gold is more than 200 tons, and we produce a lot of quantity of sesame, and also we have livestock, which is, you know, subject to be exported to African and Arab countries. And we have a lot of, this is fruit and sorghum and seeds. But, you know, our country is very rich. We have a lot of resources. But the problem now is how to control and how to administer these resources and how to control the borders between Sudan and other countries in Africa. As you know, that has thousands of kilometers that represent the borders between Sudan and Chad and South Sudan and Ethiopia and Eritrea, and a lot of smuggling of products from Sudan to the neighboring countries, including sugar and the wheat and other commodities that are very essential for Sudanese people. If I think that the government, succeed to establish a proper police to administer the resources of the country, I think that this will be and pave the way for the final solution of such crisis.
Dr. Rabi Abdoulaye Tiobaer is an advisor to the Sudanese Communications Minister. He spoke with me from Khartoum. A Zambian parliamentarian says the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, plans to begin impeachment proceedings against President Edgar Lungu when parliament reopens next year. Douglas Siakalima, an advisor to Hakainde Hichilema, leader of the UPND, also says the president should not be allowed to break the law with impunity. The UPND failed to impeach President Lungu after accusing him of violating the constitution by failing to hand over power to the Speaker of the National Assembly. For more about the new impeachment plans, I reached parliamentarian Douglas Siakalima in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
The plans are there because one of the reasons why the other impeachment motion was not tabled, some people went to the court and said there are few things which were included which were in courts of law. One of them, that one where he had threatened the judges. So now that thing is no longer there, therefore it is now a standalone impeachment issue, like offense. And so we want to do that because there's no way that the president can continue to transgress the law. And you know, our constitution is quite straightforward. Once you break the constitution or any other written law, for that matter, as a president, that is a straightforward reason why parliament can impeach. And since the president has continued to transgress our constitution and some of these other laws, we cannot continue just looking at him like that.
Which specific laws did the president break for which you seek to impeach him?
Remember when he was in Fulwezi, he had threatened the judges that if they don't rule in his favor, there was going to be chaos. So that alone, okay? Regardless of what has happened in the Constitutional Court, just that alone is an impeachable offense.
Will the UPND have the numbers in Parliament to have this impeachment proceedings begin? And how successful do you think it's going to be, based on the fact that the ruling Patriotic Front has a majority in Parliament?
Well, it does not really matter whether we have numbers or not. What matters is that it's a matter of principle. In any case, even the other time, we reached the threshold, okay, with other people joining us into signing, because it's one third which is required. One third is about 56 or so, but we had around 60. So we reached more than the threshold to begin the process. And in any case, on the way, even those who are in Patriotic Front, there would be reasoning to say that here, I think we are in trouble as a country, all right? We cannot let just a person to be doing that. It's a matter of principle,
and everybody who has a principle should be able to follow suit.
But some Patriotic Front Party members are saying this is just fraught with political machinations by the UPND, and you want to stay relevant. You could not defeat him at the ballot, and you want to use all kinds of means to remove him. And that is not even going to succeed because you don't have the numbers anyway, they said. How do you respond to that?
It doesn't matter. As I have told you, it's a constitutional issue, and so no one can say that this is a political matter we're trying to play around. No, these are serious matters. Eh? We're talking about democracy. We're talking about the rule of law. You look at how the police are behaving under his nose. There's a lot of violence coming from his party. It is under his nose, okay? The police, they are not following the law and the order. It's themselves who are supposed to maintain it. That is under his nose. The framers of our constitution knew that man can be a terrible person. You cannot just be waiting and say that within 5 years you have elections. No. The reason why they put those certificates is because man can easily change even if they were good at first. On the way, they can be bad.
You are a parliamentarian yourself. What are the prospects of succeeding to impeach President Edgar Chagwalungu?
We can succeed. I think we will succeed. Even that other time, we knew that we succeed. This is why probably they checked around and said that how do we delay this thing? Okay? So you can delay an issue, but you cannot succeed to stop it. Because it's a constitutional matter anyway.
Douglas Siakalima is a Zambian parliamentarian. He spoke with me from Lusaka. Botswana President Eric Masisi has fired local government and rural development minister Pelenomi Venson. Franz Solomon, her replacement, has since been sworn into office. Ms. Venson, who was also a former foreign minister, was sacked a day after posting on Twitter that she plans to challenge the president for the leadership of the ruling Botswana People's Party ticket at the next elective Congress. For the latest political development, I reach Dumelang Salishandu, leader of the opposition Botswana Congress Party in the capital, Habaroni.
The announcement was not totally unexpected. It's been a bit of a tense moment within the ruling party because the immediate former president, Khama, and current president, Masisi, have not been in the best of terms. So that conflict, that tension was bound to result in some grouping in the party identifying a candidate that would take on President Masisi. And it so happens that it's Pelenomi Venson, the longest-serving minister currently in cabinet.
What does this mean for the democracy in Botswana?
It's going to test the president's hold on the party. It's the first time for the BDP that a sitting president is being challenged for that position. And I suspect that is what explains the uneasiness as experienced by the manner in which Masisi has responded by dropping her immediately from cabinet. But it will also be the first time that Masisi contests for any position in the party without the backing or support of former President Khama. There's a sense of panic within the ruling party.
There are suggestions that Pelenomi Venson Motoa, who has announced to challenge the president for the leadership of the ruling party, is being influenced by former President Ian Khama because of the tension between Ian Khama and current President Masisi. What do you make of this assessment?
Look, I think that's a reasonable speculation to make. It's a big call for Pelenomi Venson. It possibly could be a move that will either catapult him to top leadership or a move that will spell the end completely of her political career. She obviously must be making it after talking to certain key influential figures in the party. And I don't think there's anyone who wields greater influence than former President Khama outside those who are currently in cabinet. So if he's going to challenge the status quo, it would have to be with the backing of Khama. Incidentally, one paper reported today that President Khama has said that he supports Pelenomi Venson for the top position. That's not too surprising.
As an opposition leader, a prominent one that who has gone into battle with the ruling party in general elections, what do you think her chances are really, in spite of the backing she received from former President Ian Khama?
It's never easy to challenge a sitting president. So the odds are essentially stacked against her. President Masisi will have the use of state resources. He'll be crisscrossing the country using the presidential helicopters and planes, whilst Pirunu Ivenson, now without her ministerial position, is essentially on her own. President Khama's influence is not as possibly as high as it was when he was still a sitting president, but you can't also write him off. He is not only a former president, he's also a tribal leader, and the leader, if I may say, of the biggest tribe in the country. If not numerically, but certainly by the geographical area over which he has jurisdiction as a chief.
Some are suggesting that President Masisi was petty by deciding to fire the minister because she decided she would challenge for the top leadership of the party. That is what democracy is about. Firing her for her decision basically undermines the internal democracy that the ruling party seeks to portray to the people of Botswana or Matswanans and the international community. What is your take?
I think that is a fair comment to make. Pirunu Ivenson has essentially, in the eyes of many, not done anything that should have gotten her sacked from the job. Expressing a desire to contest for a higher position, expressing ambition, appears forbidden within the ruling party. In the past, when Masisi was vice president, he was challenged for the position of chairman of the party by other sitting cabinet ministers. And President Khama, though viewed as possibly the most undemocratic leader of our time, did not take any action against his minister who decided to challenge Khama's deputy. So it obviously is an expression of lack of inner party democracy, but it's also just an expression of sheer intolerance by the leader.
Dumelang Salishando is the leader of the opposition Botswana Congress Party. He spoke with me from Habaroni. Cameroon has reopened its southwestern border with Nigeria after about a year of closure as a result of conflict between Cameroon's military and armed separatists fighting to create an English-speaking country. For VOA Moki, Edward Kenzeka reports from Cameroon's border village of Ekok.
We are all brothers and sisters of the same country. We need to be living in peace.
A senior official from Cameroon's military pleads with the population of Ekok village on the southwestern border with Nigeria to consider the soldiers as friends who are only out to protect civilians. The soldier says civilians should not be afraid of opening their shops in the border market and that the locals should say something whenever they see strange people in their village. 46-year-old Cameroon businessman Christopher Effiom buys food from Cameroon and takes to Nigeria, where it is sold. When he is returning from Nigeria, he buys motor spare parts and sells them in Cameroon. He says the presence of the military in the border market has chased fighters to the bushes and across the border to Nigeria. He says for a month now, merchants have been able to do business even though fighting between the military and the separatists is ongoing.
There are days that the military go down to attack the boys, and when they go down, there's serious gun shooting. So many casualties are on the field. The armed fighters, they usually block us on the way. You can never predict when they are there. There are days that even the military are unable to carry out the convoy up to Nigeria.
By Amba, he was referring to the self-declared English-speaking region of Ambazonia, where armed separatists are fighting for independence. 32-year-old Cameroon businessman Cletus Ndungang says although the military has reopened the border, business has yet to resume fully because most buyers and sellers are still not convinced that the situation is completely peaceful.
80% of our rice is imported. It's very risky for a businessman to carry rice knowing that there's going to be a problem. Even maize, you also have oil, we have sugar. In fact, all the food, there's a problem. Because of this barbaric act, most of the businessmen do not want to come in.
When Cameroon declared war on the armed separatists in November 2017, it said gunmen were attacking border localities in Cameroon's southwest and escaping to Nigeria. Nigeria denied assailants were crossing over from its territory into Cameroon. Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of Cameroon's southwest region, says collaboration between the Nigerian and Cameroon militaries is bringing peace to the border areas and business is resuming, but he says civilians who sought to escape the Cameroonian military and the fighters should consider the military as their partners in fighting for peace to return to their localities.
L'armée accompagne, nous accompagne les populations aujourd'hui.
He says there is now some general awareness that the military is out just to accompany and protect civilians so they can go about their daily activities in peace and without fear. He says only this newfound synergy between civilians and their military will make it possible for social and economic activities to resume fully. He says they are pleading with civilians to go to the army when they see any threat to security and that people should know that the army is there only for them. Trade between Cameroon and Nigeria stagnated in January following the closure of the border in an attempt to prevent separatist fighters from launching attacks on Cameroonian territory and escaping to Nigeria. Communities at the Cameroonian border village of Ekok have been greatly affected as much of their livelihood depends on cross-border trade. They expect business to be revived with end-of-year feast. Cameroon buys food items from Nigeria and supplies Nigerian markets with produce. The separatist insurgency gained pace in 2017 following a government crackdown on peaceful protests by Anglophones who complained of being marginalized by the French-speaking majority. Some political leaders have called on President Paul Biya to initiate dialogue with the separatists, but Biya, who has ruled Cameroon for 36 years, has refused any talks on Cameroon becoming a divided state. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Ekok, southwestern Cameroon.
The United States has a new Africa policy. When National Security Advisor John Bolton unveiled this strategy earlier this month, he focused on how America needs to counter Chinese interest across the continent. VOA Salem Solomon spoke with Yun Sun, director of the China program at the Stimson Center, about whether criticism from Washington will affect Sino-Africa relations.
Not much, honestly. When the Chinese look at their lending practice in Africa, what they care more about is the reaction from the recipient countries and whether the recipient governments and the recipient local communities are willing to work with China. As for the U.S. opposition or the U.S. grievance or the U.S. complaints about China being being predatory in this process, I don't think it really affects the Chinese decision making.
What does that say about the gravity of the concerns over what experts and observers are calling debt trap policy?
There are two things that we're talking about. The first one is debt. The second one is diplomacy. And I know that debt trap diplomacy has been pretty much used as one term to describe what China is doing in these countries. However, if you look from an analytical point of view, first of all, whether the debt trap was created intentionally to advance China's strategic goals in Africa, I think that's a debatable question. I think looking from an analytical point of view in Africa and in the West, especially in the United States, what we do see is the result or the consequences of the Chinese debts. But I think as a China analyst, when you look at the decision making in China about how these projects came along and whether the Chinese intentionally set out to create these debt traps in order to advance their strategic interest, I think that's a different question.
But how valid is the narrative that's created in debt trap policy?
Debt trap and lending traps are the two sides of the same coin. As much as the recipient government do not want to be fixated or do not want to fall into a debt trap, I don't think China wants to be in the position that they are facing. They're faced with a lending trap either, because these are Chinese taxpayers' money. These are Chinese foreign reserves, and this money in the end have to be accounted for. Although the Chinese government is authoritarian government, it doesn't mean that their investment does not require any return. But I think the message for the West is that is not to just lobby the African government to see the Chinese investment as an evil, evil gift or a gift with hidden agenda. I think it's also important for the West to come up with an alternative for these governments to at least resort to.
Yoon Sun is the director of the China program at the Stimson Center. She spoke with viewers Salem Solomon from Washington. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Belgium has long struggled to deal with its colonial past, a period that saw millions of Africans in Congo and Rwanda die from disease, starvation, and violence. Now the country's Royal Museum for Central Africa, which once housed looted colonial treasures, including a human zoo, has undergone a five-year, $73 million revamp in an effort to show the reality of empire and of modern Africa. For viewing, Henry Ridgewell reports from Brussels.
The Royal Museum for Central Africa opened in 1910 as a showcase for Belgian might and for the empire and the colonial riches it delivered. Museum director Guido Griesels says more than a century later, museum curators have attempted a complete reversal.
Our aim was to make a museum of contemporary Africa on the Africa of today, but at the same time to also bring a very critical look on the colonial past of Belgium. We recognize now the many victims of colonization, the African victims of colonization. We recognize too that there were a lot of the racist attitudes that were developed at that time have their consequences today.
Those attitudes are personified by a group of statues showing Africans as primitive and savage. They used to be dotted around the museum but are now grouped in the basement. Other artifacts have been given new captions explaining their provenance and displayed alongside modern African art. Videos offer African perspectives on culture, colonialism, and climate change. Not everything can be recast. Built into the walls are statues of Africans gazing adoringly at their white masters, with titles like Belgium Brings Well-being to Congo. The ornate grounds once housed a human zoo of more than 250 Congolese. Seven died from exposure to the cold after being forced to wear traditional dress. King Leopold II commissioned the museum to generate investment for mining and rubber production in the colonies. His name is synonymous with the brutality of empire. It is estimated that up to 15 million Congolese died through disease, famine, and genocide. Mireille Tsiosi Robert of the anti-racism organisation Bamco Cran argues the museum has not gone far enough in displaying the horrors of colonialism. Robert says that when the museum is not presented as a museum of colonisation, but instead as a museum of Africa, that really confuses the issue. Honestly, she says, we need to make a real museum of colonization. We need to deal with our colonial history. It is really something that is missing in Belgium. Then there is the question of where these treasures belong. Hundreds of thousands were looted. Director Griesels says he is open to returning stolen goods.
Well, certainly it's not normal that 80% of African art is in European museums or in European private collections. So we have to make sure that they can get much greater access to our collection. Congo at the moment lacks capacity to deal with a lot of that heritage.
Among those attending the opening this month was the director of Congo's museums, Paul Bakwalufu Badibanga. He insists any artifacts returned to his country would be secure.
Donc la sécurité, ça ne doit pas être un problème, un prétexte.
Badibanga says the issue of security is not a real problem. It is a pretext for not giving back the objects. The revamp of this famous institution has forced Belgium to confront its colonial past. Those behind the project say this is one more step on the long road to reconciliation. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the Museum of Africa, Brussels.
More demonstrations were reported Friday in a number of Sudanese towns and cities. They followed several days of anti-government protests tied to deteriorating economic conditions and widespread public anger towards Sudan President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who took power in a coup nearly 30 years ago. For VOA, Edward Uranian has more from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Hundreds of protesters in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, chanted slogans Friday against the government of President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, including the popular Arab Spring slogan, "The people want to topple the regime." It was the fourth day of protests over rising prices and political oppression. Social media reported protests in more than half a dozen districts of Khartoum Thursday, in addition to multiple demonstrations in the neighboring city of Omdurman. Amateur video showed a top regional official in Gadarif, thought to be the governor of the town, fleeing an angry crowd in a four-wheel drive vehicle. The crowd pelted the car with stones. Gadarif has been a hotbed of protests where a curfew has been imposed. Photos on Twitter showed government buildings which had been set ablaze by angry protesters. Some photos showed government soldiers observing the demonstrations without intervening, while others showed security forces firing tear gas at protesters. Rabia Abdul Ati, a leader of the ruling National Congress Party, said popular protests are legitimate to a certain extent. He says that it is normal for citizens to protest fuel shortages and rising bread prices, but condemned what he called troublemakers who are exploiting popular discontent to ransack public and private property. Prime Minister Mu'taz Musa told a press conference several days ago that the current economic crisis has been a long time in the making. Musa says the ongoing economic difficulties the people are experiencing over shortages of hard currency, bread, fuel, and medicine are the result of flaws in the economy which go back many years. Sudanese political leader Sadiq al-Mahdi, who was overthrown in the coup led by President Bashir in 1989, recently returned from exile in Egypt. Photos on social media showed the former prime minister in the midst of a crowd of demonstrators. Al-Hadi Azzedine, a Sudanese journalist in Cairo, told VOA that the Sudanese people were revolting against what he called a dictatorial regime. He says the government has been in power for 30 years and that it governs by force, preventing people from expressing their opinions or beliefs freely. It uses force and oppression, he says, to subdue opposition. President Bashir has been trying to amend the constitution to allow him to run for another term. Separately, Bashir met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad after traveling to Damascus Sunday on a Russian plane. It was the first visit by an Arab head of state to the Syrian capital since the Assad government was expelled from the Arab League in 2011. There has been speculation in the Arab media that Bashir is seeking a country that might grant him exile if he were forced to resign. Bashir is wanted on an arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court for genocide and war crimes committed in the Darfur region in the early 2000s. It is thought that a number of countries have told him that they would not grant him exile. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Spain's Real Madrid won the Club World Cup for a third consecutive year and record fourth in total by beating Abu Dhabi side Al Ain in the final on Saturday. Real Madrid have won four of the past five Club World Cups. Al Ain had shocked River Plate on penalties in the semi-final, but never looked like following that up with a famous win at the Zayed Sports City Stadium in Abu Dhabi. Real now hold the record for most victories in the competition, which was first held in 2000, moving one clear of Spanish rivals Barcelona. Earlier, River Plate won the third place playoff by beating Asian champions Kashima Antlers 4-0. Gonzalo Martinez scored twice on what is expected to be his final appearance before joining MLS champions Atlanta United. Meanwhile, African champions Esperance of Tunisia were beaten by home side Al Ain FC, losing 3-0 in the quarterfinals of the tournament. In other news, Senegal has ended 2018 as the highest-rated African nation on the final FIFA World Rankings of this year. The Teranga Lions have not played since November's rankings and so remained at 23rd globally. There has been little movement on the December rankings, with very few international games having been played. Zimbabwe and Sierra Leone both moved up a single place, thanks to the Philippines slipping two spots after two defeats since November's rankings. Guinea-Bissau also moved up one place to join 120 with Tajikistan, who have also lost two matches since November. The only other African nation to move on the latest list is Zambia, who fell one place to 83rd as they were leapfrogged by Oman on the back of two wins in the last month. Africa's top 10 on December's FIFA rankings are thus Senegal in first place, Tunisia in second, Morocco in third, followed by Nigeria, DR Congo, Ghana, Cameroon, Egypt, Burkina Faso, and Mali. And FIFA has released the World Cup final audience figures. FIFA says 885 million viewers tuned in to traditional TV coverage and a further 231 million watching outside the home or digitally. In total, according to FIFA, a combined 3.5 billion viewers, more than half of the global population aged 4 and over, tuned in to world football's ultimate competition for at least a minute over the course of the World Cup from June 14th to July 15th. A combined global audience of 1.1 billion watched the World Cup final between France and Croatia in July, according to FIFA. Finally, in athletics, Kenya's Olympic 10,000-meter silver medalist Paul Tanui and World Half Marathon bronze medalist Pauline Kamulu will compete at the Northern Ireland International Cross Country in Belfast on January 19th. Tanui took the silver medal in the senior men's race at the 2011 IAAF World Cross Country Championships and went on to earn three successive world bronze medals over 10,000 meters between 2013 and 2017. The 27-year-old will be tested by fellow Kenyan Richard Yato, the World Under-20 cross-country bronze medalist and 2015 World Under-18 3,000-meter champion. Just 2 months ago, Yato clocked 10,000 meters personal best of 27.14.70, making him the second fastest man in the world this year at the distance. Kamulu is the fastest woman in the world this year, over 10,000 meters, having clocked a personal best of 30.41.85 in July. Earlier in the year, the 23-year-old finished third at the World Half Marathon Championships, Valencia, 2018, taking more than a minute off her personal best with 1 hour, 6 minutes and 55 seconds. Ethiopia's World Under-20 cross-country silver medalist, Hawi Fayesa, will also be in Belfast and is expected to provide a stiff competition for Kamulu. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You will hear from Diamond featuring Neo, Mariyu, Rema and Chris Evans with Linda.
Tagwe mukwano guno Tokuzanyi sagu kwa tempola Oh Tokuita kuyomba na olava Bangali wesenga nkulize hani Totuka Olwayo munange Obanga gamba Tife na yenga nkukoze ichi nesi motu gantuge neta wanen kaba choko to say atera obinda.
Chona uchimani naluli na kuolugoye neloto ndavye echidoye kwewe nota nelo esise tumumu baka sister wange ya kukume echido olemeo kutia mungu kuba chizibu nino kufuba no nyansibi tuazime eneme chukako kale tonyiga tokaba ninda wikienja sente zizo nenze kumirimu. Maden kulo waza konze kanzi jani sinde kulabe koka tono ngende njie. Oh baby I got to go.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Anyone who has been following closely the political development in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, could not have been surprised that 3 days before elections was to be held today, 23rd December, the Electoral Commission announced that the elections have been postponed from today until the 30th of December. The government of President Kabila has adopted a strategy to prolong his stay as president by a novel means. Instead of changing the constitution of the DRC to prolong his rule, as many African leaders have done, it decided to follow delays. The first point in this strategy was that the Constitutional Court of the DRC in 2016 announced that should the elections be delayed in 2016, the incumbent president, President Kabila, should remain in office until elections were held. Shortly after that court ruling, the Electoral Commission of the DRC announced that it lacked funds and could not hold the elections in 2016 in accordance with the Constitution. Therefore, President Kabila, who should have vacated office in 2016, continued. Despite protest and loss of life, the president could not budge. There were negotiations by the Catholic Church, and there were agreements, and these agreements were violated. But at the beginning of 2018, the Electoral Commission of the DRC announced that there definitely would be election this year, 23rd December, for a change of government. So as plans were being put forward, close observers were watching to see what will be the next pretext for the delay. When the Ebola outburst came, there were fears that this outbreak of Ebola will be used to delay. But because there are presence of international observers where there were the Ebola outburst, no, that was not used. But a few weeks ago, news was made that electronic machine which was stored in a warehouse in the capital, as there were fires, and they have been completely destroyed. Keep in mind that the opposition was opposed to the use of electronic machine on the grounds that because of the high illiteracy in the DRC, the people would be confused and that these electronic machines would be subject to manipulation. Again, there were suspicions, but the opposition decided to exercise restraint and not go out into the street to protest, because this might be used to either cancel the election or delay. So there were also a number of provocations. One of the opposition candidates, Peter Fayulu, was told that he could not campaign in Kinshasa, the capital. No, not much good reasons were given. And they were afraid that people would come out into the street and this could have reached some violence. But again, the opposition exercised restraint because they do want a change of government. So it was not a surprise that just Wednesday, the announcement was made to change the date from today until the 30th of December. Let us hope that the government keeps that date. But one has to look at the argument that is being made by the government. The ambassador of the DRC in the United Kingdom just last week gave an interview where she was praising President Kabila for having agreed to vacate his office and hold election. And the reason she gave is that around the DRC, all these governments have not changed the president. Of course, he was referring to Uganda, he was referring to Burundi and Rwanda, where they have used change of constitution to remain in office. And there is also a big surprise that at the time this delay was announced, suddenly the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, issued a stern warning that any electoral violence will be subject to prosecution, as it was done in Kenya. So one wonders what is the intent of that. But luckily, the opposition are sophisticated. They understand that they should not allow themselves to be provoked and that they should just go along with the Electoral Commission. Now, it is possible for the United Nations Peacekeeping Force deployed in the DRC to assist the government in distributing electoral materials to all the districts in position in such a vast country. Because we do not know what would happen if there is any further delay. The people of the DRC have made it clear that they are opposed to any further delays in the election. And it is therefore an obligation on the part of all concerned, the Security Council, the African Union, and the wider international community to make sure and to appeal to the government of the DRC that there be no further delay in order to spare the people of the DRC violence and bloodshed. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when fire starts from the shrine, no precaution can be possible. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.